This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. On today's Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Professor Steve Keane. He's an Australian economist and author of The New Economics, a manifesto, as he shares his perspective on why the study of economics really requires a major reformation. A very good morning to you, Professor. Many are beginning to forecast a recession at the end of this year, or at least by next year. Do you feel vindicated that, or do we expect it to be far worse than many expect it to be?
It'll be more severe than the central banks expect, because what they're doing is following conventional economics that basically says the interest rate controls people's decisions to invest and decisions to consume. And by increasing it a bit, we'll reduce those and take demand pressure off the economy. Inflation will fall. There'll be a rise in unemployment, but it'll be a soft landing. That's the usual sort of thing they think. What they don't understand, and this is where you need a complete revision of economics, is that credit, which is the annual change in private debt, actually contributes to income and demand, and aggregate demand and aggregate expenditure, as economists call them both, because that extra money is created by the banking system. And when nobody borrows for the sheer pleasure of being in debt. So when you borrow, you're borrowing to spend. And because the bank is creating that money, that is an addition to demand. And it works exactly in reverse. So if you suddenly have a huge increase in interest rates, people decide to pay debt down or they go bankrupt, then credit turns negative. So the annual change in private debt is negative rather than positive. That subtracts from demand. Mm. Now, that's the factor they're not putting into their mindsets. What they expect of being a soft landing is going to be more like hitting a very large pothole.
So these rate hikes that everyone is contemplating to do really is the wrong solution. It is counter to the solution that we are endeavoring or hoping for in terms of a soft landing.
Yeah, well, certainly it's not easy to control the sort of inflation we're suffering from now. And what they're using is an approach that would have controlled that inflation if it was driven by some of the same factors that drove the inflation in the 1970s. And that was primarily an absolutely buoyant economy with a large credit bubble driving it too. But you had very low unemployment. Workers were getting large wage demands in excess of the rate of inflation, which was driving up inflation itself. Well, at the moment, we all know that even though inflation is high, wages are not rising anywhere near as fast as inflation. So they're using a tool which would work in different circumstances on part of the inflation. But as usual, it'll hit the economy more severely than they expect.
And what we are very worried about is we don't really want to see a repeat of the Asian financial crisis of the 1997s, right? Where many of the banks hopefully are now structurally more stable. But in terms of the current economic situation you're in, can you draw parallels and similarities to the previous crises that we've had before?
No. This is actually quite different. The Asian financial crisis was due to large amounts of borrowed money financing speculation on commercial real estate predominantly. And when you look at the data, which is the data I'm talking about, the annual change in debt, particularly for Thailand, you just see an absolute plunge in credit-driven demand at that stage from very, very buoyant, very high levels to very low. Now, you don't have a very high level, so you've got to have a very high level of demand initially to make that really a deep plunge, which is what the Asian financial crisis was. So you haven't got quite the same height you're jumping off. You're not going to fall quite as far. So it'll be a jolt, but it won't be like the Asian financial crisis. The main thing that's happening now is the cost of supply has been driven up. Now, with the type of inflation that the Federal Reserve's policies actually work on is where you've got workers getting high wage demands, which of course is wrong now. The sort of inflation we're getting is driven by increasing cost of supply, largely by a breakdown in the global supply chain. And there's not much you can do to stop that. The only way you can mean that rising cost doesn't feed through to higher prices is either workers take real wage cuts, which is happening, but the working class really can't afford it, or corporations accept lower markups. And with the power of the corporate sector, they're not about to do that unless they see their bottom line really collapsing. So this inflation is going to persist for a while.
And this is the point you make about greater inequality as a result of the actions taken by governments all around the world?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons we have such huge inequality, and this is quite complicated to explain, but it's in the data, it's in the way that I mathematically model the economy as well. Rising levels of private debt cause lower incomes for the working class. Even though it's the corporations that are borrowing, it's the workers that pay for it by a lower share of income. So we've got to a situation of extreme high levels of private debt, which is partly causing extremely low worker share of income. And the only way out of it is to reduce that private debt. But that's the last thing that the conventional economists think is important, and it would affect the wealthy as well. So it's not about to be done by those in power.
So let's expand on that, because you believe that focusing on public debt to the exclusion of private debt is extremely dangerous. Could you expand on that point a bit further?
Yeah, sure. Public debt. People worry about public debt. It's a real panic in mainstream economics, and politicians and journalists have all accepted their arguments. And what they say is they treat everything in terms of supply and demand. So you have a supply of money, and you have a demand for money. And if the demand for money rises, then the interest rate will rise, and that affects the rest of the economy. And if the government takes the money, there's less for the private sector, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way they think. They're 100% wrong, because you have to think about this as an accountant does. And what does a government do when it spends more than it taxes? It pays more money into private bank accounts than it takes out of them. So that spending actually creates money. And on the other side of the ledger, for that to happen, you've got a rise in bank assets, there has to be also a rise in bank liabilities, because deposits, bank accounts are a liability of the banking sector. There has to be a rise in the assets as well. And the assets that rise when the government spends money are the reserves. So there's, as well as, so let's say America and a government runs a $1 trillion deficit, it therefore increases reserves by $1 trillion. That $1 trillion sitting on the asset side of the bank's ledger is earning no interest, and you can't trade reserves. So when the government says we're going to sell $1 trillion of government bonds, and this is what people call government debt, when they sell that $1 trillion worth of bonds, the banks use the reserves that were created by the deficit to buy the bonds. So it's an asset swap for them. So they swap a non-tradable, non-interest earning asset, the reserves, for a tradable income earning asset called the bonds. Of course they'll do it. There's no danger
naturally
that that won't happen. You require banks who would turn down a free lunch. And I've never met a banker who will turn down a free lunch, okay? So it's crazy to worry about that. And they can expand, and the government then finances them the same way it creates them. So it's not a problem, whereas private debt is.
Yeah, so let's talk about private debt in a bit of more detail, because you've actually laid out some markers that a country is in trouble when private debt is 1.5 times that of GDP, credit growth is about 10% of GDP. Which countries are in that list at the moment?
Virtually every country on the planet. That's the problem. It has become widespread. And before the COVID crisis, most countries already exceeded 1.5 times GDP as their private debt level, 150%. So, for example, Australia is about 200%.
Yeah. France, Singapore, Canada. These countries are all there, but they're far from in any process of economic collapse, right? So surely you can't be right.
They're fragile to a reduction in debt. So once you get to those levels, if credit's providing an additional 10% on your normal GDP in terms of demand, then that 10% disappearing makes a difference. Whereas down at the 2% level or 3% level, then it doesn't make much of a difference. So it's again, there's a bit that analogy, the step versus the cliff that I spoke about with that.
I wonder then, when do we reach that cliff? What is that trigger point where we're going to see really these economies where we have this perception that they are in such stable conditions really show structural weakness and collapse?
Well, then we've seen as much collapse. Well, there'll be a much sharper collapse fall in demand than people are expecting. So basically, this is what's going to happen when central banks put up interest rates, because what they think is they're fine-tuning. See, they're leaving out of their logic the role of credit and aggregate demand, because they don't believe there is one. Read Ben Bernanke in explaining why he didn't take seriously Irving Fisher's what he called debt deflation theory of Great Depressions back in the 1930s. Bernanke said, absent implausibly large differences in the propensity to spend, pure redistributions should have no significant macroeconomic effect. And they all still believe that. But that's a model of banking in which banks enable savers to lend to borrowers. And then when you have an increase in interest rates, then borrowers repay savers. But somebody's still got the money to spend. That's the way they think.
Yeah.
But in fact, when you repay a bank, your bank deposit goes down and the asset goes down. Money is actually destroyed by repaying debt. And that's something I didn't understand initially, I must admit. It took me a while to appreciate that. So this is what's going to happen in addition to that, what they think is going to happen for putting interest rates up.
So let's keep this example real life, because Sri Lanka is one classic example where we've seen private debt, you know, account for just only 38% of its nominal GDP in December 2021, and yet it's still on the verge of collapse. So do your markers about private debt still hold then?
Oh, yeah, there are different factors which can cause a crisis. I mean, Sri Lanka is an incredibly complex set of story involving an attempt to change the nature of agriculture right in the middle of, you can't jump from a fertilizer base to a natural based agriculture overnight. I think there are a lot of Sri Lanka, I think I'd have to leave out as a special case, just too extreme. But in the rest of the world, if you have a high level of credit-based demand and then you put interest rates up and it means people stop taking out borrowed money, then you can see 10% of your aggregate demand and income disappear overnight. It'll mainly affect asset markets initially because that's what most borrowed money is used to buy. But it will hit the economy much harder than the central banks expect, which is why I think they'll ultimately reverse direction.
Let's talk about solutions. You advocate for this modern day jubilee where an agreement to use the capacity of the government sector to create private money, right, and use that money as a fiat-based money and use it to replace credit-based money. Is that populist and irresponsible?
It's populist, but it would be responsible at the same time. I mean, we've been persuaded that populism means bad policy. And in the meantime, what we've had is an incredible increase in the power of the wealthy. So I think we've been conned a bit to associate populism. This would be popular, okay? It would be unpopular, only people would still be thinking about it in terms of an ancient theory of economics that still dominates how we think about the world today. But yes, it would be popular. It would be effective.
It would be most certainly popular for sure. But doesn't that create a moral hazard for those individuals who really don't have high levels of individual debt?
This is why I've said that we should be using that power to give everybody an equal amount of money. So you don't just let debtors off the hook. You give everybody an equal amount of fiat-created money. But you then can control it so that those who have debt have to pay their debt down. But those who don't have debt get government bonds, which have been created the same way I spoke about earlier, which the government can easily finance. So they don't get an asset they don't get money they can spend on assets themselves. They get money that gives them an income stream. And you can fine tune that in terms of the amount of demand you might need to have at the time. But the main thing is we've allowed the private banking sector to create too much of our money supply and the government to create too little by this fetish about how bad government deficits are, when government deficits are a way of creating effectively debt-free money for the private sector. So we have to correct that mistake, which we could do very quickly. And then we have to stop banks lending for asset bubbles again. That's the real problem.
Yeah, it really sounds like the private banking sector really is not the efficient intermediary, right, to support the economy here.
It's not an intermediary at all. It's a creator, and this is the mistake we've made. We treat the government as a borrower of money and the banks as intermediaries of money, not actually ask, well, who creates it then? And the answer is both governments create debts, money by running a deficit, banks create money by lending out more than they get back in repayments. So the two mechanisms to create money. And if you let one of them take on too much, you get too much private debt backing your money rather than government money creation capability. And then that can lead to all sorts of failures because most of that money is used to speculate on rising asset prices. And you get an asset price bubble, which of course is incredibly fragile, as you know, from the Asian financial crisis. And the West finally learned again from the global financial crisis. But it seems no lesson can be learned in the modern world and persisted with because we continue believing these mythical versions of the economy. And of course, there are individuals who do very nicely out of it and want to continue doing nicely out of it.
And the bigger question is, why are we not learning all these lessons from past experiences? On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Professor Steve Keen, an Australian economist and author of the new book, New Economics, A Manifesto. After the break, how economic theory needs to intertwine with energy, environment and social media. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Professor Steve Keen. He's an Australian economist and author of The New Economics, A Manifesto, as we get his perspective on what macroeconomists all around the world have gone wrong. Professor, let's talk about some of the macroeconomic factors that will change the economy, starting with the pandemic. What lessons have we not learned?
Well, fundamentally, whenever we have a crisis like the Great Depression, or the Second World War, or the global financial crisis, or COVID, governments simply forget what they've been told, they panic. and they throw money at the system. And that's what they should be doing most of the time. Because what then happens, you have this mystery of how come there's been so much saving of private money? How many people have saved so much money during the pandemic? It's the reason, because the government created that money and it necessarily turns up in people's private bank accounts. And that's why we had the shortest recession in history, really, with COVID, because governments immediately went to government deficits from, you know, panicking about running 3% of GDP as a deficit, which is the Europeans' level, to 25%. And what that meant was they created 25% of GDP's worth of money in private bank accounts. And even with all the restrictions of COVID, we spent.
So earlier we talked about this debt jubilee. I believe, you know, what you are referring here is that these cash stimulus and handouts that many governments all around the world, including Malaysia, is quite close to that concept, right? Quite close-ish, isn't it?
Yeah, it's easy to do. This is the crazy thing. The government can easily create money. This is what a fiat currency is all about. Fiat means by command. Mm. And if the king decides to create that money, then the king can create that money. Now, it's question what's going to be the long-term consequences of that. And in mainstream economic theory, that'll make money. It'll take money away. This is the crazy thing. The opposite of what can happen. They say the king creating money will take money away from you. Hello? A bit of thinking is required there. But fiat money can be created by fiat, which is what is done. A complicated system we use these days. It's not quite like the king minting more coins as it used to be in feudal times. But it is quite straightforward to create that money. And then the consequences are not what they expect. The consequences are actually what we've seen, a dramatic increase in demand. And that's what you have to be careful about. You don't want to do so much that you overstimulate the economy and cause a demand-driven inflationary boom to happen. Now, what we've had at the same time, of course, is the COVID-induced breakdowns of the supply chain. And that has made it more expensive because it takes longer to get goods sold, which adds to the cost. And you also reduce your per unit output. And again, contrary to mainstream economic theory, reducing that output increases your per unit cost. It doesn't decrease them. So all these things mean we have different effects. And as you said, we fail to learn. We go back to the conventional ways of thought. And my analogy there is always, humans didn't start to realize that the Earth was not the center of the universe until astronomers said the Earth is not the center of the universe. Mm. So we can delude ourselves for a long time. We can go back to previous ways of thinking and believing, even if reality keeps on contradicting us.
And I think that's one of the biggest contradictions, because, you know, when I hear you, the solution can be quite simple, but of course the rationale and the means and the process to get there is pretty complicated. And that's what you argue for, isn't it? That's perhaps what we do, unfortunately, is that we oversimplify the macroeconomics. We just think about it as classic supply demand, whereas what you kind of say is that we need to embrace the interconnectedness of many components of our society, the world, that actually drive macroeconomics.
Absolutely. We've got to see it in what's called a systems way. And this is where economics has been, again, resistant to progressive ways of thinking. So what's called system dynamics, it takes one system state, one fundamental thing, like, for example, population growth. And then it says, well, population growth is going to affect food demand. And food demand is going to affect, you know, your food demand will affect the amount of land you have available for industry. But rising population also pushes industry, which will expand the land used for non-agriculture. So you've got all these complex feedbacks and you're not in equilibrium. Engineers developed a technique to handle that in the 1950s called system dynamics. And economists literally rejected it. The people who created it thought economists would love the idea that they could be freed from thinking in equilibrium terms. But in fact, they've made equilibrium into an economic religion. So they resisted the whole idea. So the technology exists. I've actually developed my own system for that. I call Minsky, which is an open source free software for system dynamics modeling. And I'm teaching people how to use it. But economists resist that all the time. So it's like trying to teach a medieval believer in witchcraft that witchcraft doesn't exist. It's rather hard.
Well, let's talk about something which is definitely not witchcraft, in this case, climate change. And I presume a concept like system dynamics should apply when we talk about the interconnectedness or the relationship between macroeconomics and economic theory with climate change. So tell me a bit about how these two elements are interrelated and interconnected.
If you, the fundamental thing in system dynamics is you would include carbon dioxide as one of your system states. So we go from 280 parts per million to 420 during the industrial period as we are now. You know that will feed back on the weather, it will feed back on the distribution of energy over the entire planet, and you would necessarily include that as a limit, and everything gets affected by that. So if you have a change in where the rainfall occurs, for example, then even if people can survive where the temperature's risen, there won't be rainfall there potentially. So they've got to move. So that will affect your industry. Now, that's sort of a very basic way of thinking about it in a systemic sense. But William Nordhaus, the neoclassical economist who was given the Nobel Prize for Climate Change in 2018, literally assumed that there'd be no effect on all of manufacturing, all of services, wholesale and retail services, all of government, and all of the finance sector because of climate change, because they happen in what he called, and I quote, carefully controlled environments.
But that's not true.
That's stupid.
Far from it.
If I had a child that said that, I'd be going and giving, you know, I'd be saying, listen here, you've got to, it's stupid stuff like that. So rather than looking at the systemic feedback between those things, you see, oh, it's not going to affect them. Let's assume that 87% of the economy will not be affected by climate change. That's not systemic thinking. That's stupid thinking. But that's what economists do.
But, you know, Professor, you know, having scanned through your book, and I'm by no stretch of any imagination an economist, it's clearly written not to interpret economics, but to try and change it. So really, the question here is, why do you think that all your thoughts and perspectives have fallen on deaf ears then?
Largely, I mean, I'm not going to put myself across as Galileo, but I understand how Galileo felt when he was trying to tell his fellow astronomers at the time, the Earth is not the center of the universe. But what you see, which looks like the stars and the sun and the moon and planets are rotating around the Earth, is actually the Earth spinning on its axis, and it's rotating around the sun. And if you rethink that way, then you can understand everything. And yes, my first model's not as accurate as your models are, because I've only just worked it out. But, you know, conceptually, it's a cleaner, simpler way to understand the astronomy. They didn't just laugh at him. They got him, you know, put under house arrest by the Pope. So there's a resistance. If you have a better paradigm, then the people who are going to resist you most are those with the old paradigm. And that's what's going on here. So I've given up on trying to convince economists. I actually am telling scientists I think they should argue that economics should be driven out of universities, but there's no chance for it reforming itself. We need a genuine, this is serious. This is no longer a case of better ways of predicting next year's inflation rate. This is existential. Because we've listened to the economists, we've put the pressure the human society puts on the biosphere is 3 to 4 times what it was back in the 1970s when it was already getting dangerous. And we're now overshot and we'll face the consequences of that. And it will be an economic collapse beyond anything we've ever experienced.
I mean, Professor, you're very passionate, clearly. You want to change hearts and minds, and that's why you ran for the recent Australian election. Unfortunately, you didn't make it through to the Senate. Do you, upon reflection, looking at the results, looking at the fact that, you know, not many people are embracing your theories, do you think there needs to be a transition pathway or transition argument to get to your final point?
Good question. I think it's the question of who's going to make the transition. If it's diehard neoclassical economists, then I just simply don't think you're wasting my time if I tried that. You're never going to convince them. And this is what Max Planck, the guy who invented quantum mechanics, said. He realized the only solution to some empirical dilemmas in physics was to believe that energy came in small, discrete particles he called quanta. And he tried to persuade his fellow scientists, and he couldn't get through to them. And he finally said, effectively, science advances one funeral at a time. Now, that doesn't happen in economics because the crises we have in economics aren't as permanent as what's called the black body radiation problem or the precession of Mercury and things like that. Any student can redo the black body radiation experiment and find that the old theories don't fit it. So it's a permanent problem for science. But in economics, you've got a theory which is wrong. The Great Depression occurs and proves you wrong. You survive the Great Depression because of the Second World War. You forget about the mistake you made. You get into the 50s and 60s, et cetera, et cetera. And you can always find a few students who are going to come on and believe your stuff because it persuades them that they're living in heaven on earth. You've got this perfect system. And all we have to do is make sure the real world looks like our economics textbooks and everything will be wonderful. And they continue reproducing themselves. The critics like myself say this is nonsense. You get criticism inside the discipline, but you don't get a change in the fundamental core. So I really think, and I frankly, I've given up and hoping it'll happen. I think we're going to have to see the climate prices get far worse than what economists have told us. They're telling us it's going to reduce GDP by 10% in 2100, when we're going to be 5 times higher. Rather than being 5 times higher, we'll be 4.5 times higher than today. No big deal. When we start seeing total breakdown of food systems, inability to use energy, et cetera, then we'll start realizing they're wrong. But that won't change them. We have to have somebody else to take over from them. I want engineers and biologists to take over economics.
And that's where I do get a sense that you do revel being that outsider, being that rebel, being that unconventional, outside, not part of the fraternity, perhaps not within the within the periphery. But for you to be successful, we need to discard these terms for you and to be the ultimate insider. Are you ready to be an institutionalist?
I'm ready to be the insider, definitely. And institutionalism, in a sense, is system dynamic. You worry about the institutions and you understand the economy from its structure rather than bizarre theories about people's utility-maximizing behavior. So, yeah, I am willing to do it. I hope it happens in my lifetime, but I've got my doubts.
Sooner rather than later. Professor, thank you very much for spending your time with us. On The Breakfast Grill, Professor Steve Keane, an Australian economist and author of The New Economics. I'm Philip C., BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.